Once again, take a moment to stretch up and settle in. You can do that anytime you want to sharpen your clarity or deepen your equanimity. Stretch up, settle in. And decide what you'd like to focus on, how you'd like to focus. Maybe it's one of the options that we've been doing so far, or maybe it's some other approach to practice that appeals to you. It's all good. In a moment, when the bell rings, we'll make a seamless transition, as before, from practice in stillness to practice in motion, which is also a formal practice, 100% commitment to maintaining a technique, either something we've done so far or whatever you prefer. And once again, after about 20 minutes or so, you'll hear the bell, come back, go back to seated practice, seamless transition. Okay, good. Good work. Now, let's take a few minutes for a last little period where we'll have a chance to ask any questions or discuss experiences. Then we'll have a little practice to cap it off, and we'll be done with our program. So I think we can have a mic that circulates. And we have that. So if you just raise your hand, anything you'd like to delve into, we can do so.
I guess a report and a question. When unconsciousness sort of takes over.
You can pull the mic a little further away. Yeah, not maybe that far.
Too loud.
Yeah.
Okay. When unconsciousness takes over, and I notice a sensory event sort of at the tail end of it. What happens afterwards is sort of like I experience a little bit of a jolt in the feel system. It's sort of like an existential dread. I wonder if you've heard this report before.
So you might get a little spacey and you find that you're noting lagged behind the actual event itself, and then you get a sort of jolt of fear that comes up by way of reaction. So, and then the question was, have I heard reports like this before? And there are very few new reports. So yes, reports like this, definitely. In fact, I just wrote it up in the an article, something sort of like what you're reporting. So the ultimate goal with mindfulness is that the sensory event and the mindful awareness should be concurrent, from the Latin concurrere, meaning to run in step, like joggers who are matching stride. Okay, that's the ultimate goal. However, to get to that goal is takes a lot of practice. Until we get to that goal, there can be lag. And there's a general statistical tendency for the lag to be more or less severe depending on the sense gate. For example, if it's something somatic or sound, it's a little easier to be concurrent. The awareness and the event sort of go together. At the other end, the one where you tend to get the most conspicuous lag, what would you say? What sensory experience? Here in mental talk. Mental talk tends to like, oh my God, I've been having these thoughts for the last 15 seconds, et cetera, et cetera. So there tends to be more lag there. This is a general tendency. So it is true that ultimately we want to train our detection skill so that we can be there right at the beginning of each event, and it sort of happens on autopilot. But let's be honest, that's a long, long training. And until you sort of, you know, pay the dues with that, I think it's important to accept the fact that sometimes you're going to be late, okay? I have what I call the four OKs. It's okay to guess. Sometimes you're not really sure of the sensory category. Don't make a big deal out of it. It's okay to guess. It's okay to be a little late. If you're a second or two late, that's okay. If it's 3 or 4 seconds, forget about it. Don't even bother. Just move on to the next event. So it's okay to guess. It's okay to miss. That's the other one. It's like you're focusing on one thing and all this other stuff is happening. Well, you know, it's okay because you're having a quality moment. It's okay to guess, it's okay to miss, it's okay to be a little late, but if you're more than a few seconds late, forget about it, just move on to the next note. And it is okay to average. I talked about this yesterday. If you have a lot of rapid fire things, some people can just go, you know, like a machine gun and do that, but most of us can't. So, okay, it's okay to average. You just say every few seconds, like CN, if it was rapid fire sequence of mental image. Now, so the four OKs, it's okay to guess, it's okay to miss, it's okay to be a little late, it's okay to average. That sort of takes some of the pressure off. Knowing, however, that ultimately the goal is to be concurrent, including to be concurrent with the instant that mental talk arises, but that takes practice. What you're reporting is an instance of what I call an interaction. So I talk, you don't have to remember what I'm about to say, but I classify the clarity dimension of mindfulness into 6 subdimensions, which interestingly happen to be the exact same subdimensions that are the nuts and bolts of quantified science. How much of what, when, and where, interacting in what ways, and changing at what rates. If you have a background in science, you know it. That's what it's about. That's why you had to learn calculus. So anyway, what you're reporting comes under the category of an interaction, meaning if I miss something, I know that I'm likely to have this jolt by way of reaction. That's an interaction. A triggers B. A miss triggers this event. Now, knowing that that's likely to happen means you can be Johnny on the spot. You know what's likely going to be the next thing you're going to note after a miss is that little jolt. And you just note that as feel and just let it be and open up to it. And it's just, you treat it like any other sensory event. In other words, the observing causes a reaction. The reaction takes the form of a sensory event. You observe the reaction. And the fact that you know that that's likely to happen, that a miss is likely to trigger a jolt, means you will be concurrent with the jolt because you'll know what to look for when and just let it happen. Now, I can also make a suggestion as to a way an option that makes it more likely that your noting is concurrent, even for mental talk, which is the one, as I say, most people find it very difficult initially. So the good news is I have a suggestion and it usually works. The bad news is most people aren't willing to do it. Not like it's some horrible ordeal, but people aren't willing to do it. What it is spoken labels. So far, we've actually had two label options. One is note without labels. The other is mental labels. But I and a couple other teachers independently have come up with the idea you can also speak the labels out loud. And if you speak the labels out loud, that creates a very tight feedback loop. Because you can listen to that label stream. So if you position your attention in talk space, keep your attention positioned there, restrict your attention to just the interest in tracking mental talk. Let's say that that's where the lag tends to be, just for argument's sake. Then, and you say out loud here each time there's a new arising of mental talk, and gone each time that burst of mental talk passes, and you force yourself to say that out loud, and you do that for about an hour. After that, you probably won't lag for the rest of your career. You will have, and if it's some other sensory event, then you spoken label that event. I just gave the talk as a common example. So that's what I have to say about that.
And just a quick follow-up. I'm not sure if it's the miss or if it's the gone that causes that jolt.
Ah, now that's very interesting. Okay, that's a clear report. The miss could cause the jolt because people tend to have a judgmental reaction about, you know, not doing the practice right. But you're absolutely correct. A detection of a vanishing could cause various reactions. Some of them could be unpleasant because it's either a shock or it's frightening because you're staring right into the void. Okay, it's
that's the experience.
Yeah, coup de vide. Avre knows what that means. Coup de vide means the blow of the void. It's actually a term from alpine climbing. You know, people look down and it's like, ah, you know, that's called coup de vide. It's like the void hits you. Except we can actually, in practice, there really is a sort of stroke of the void that can hit you. And each gone, for just a moment, you're actually looking down the face of a cliff that points to the unborn. You're looking into the abyss whence we come and whither we return. And initially that might cause a fear jolt, but it can also cause like a real sort of bliss jolt. Also, it's not necessarily the case that it's going to be uncomfortable all along. That jolt that now is a little bit of a fear can actually evolve into this delicious crack in the cosmic egg that gives you this place you can look out to freedom and okayness and whatever. So let's give the possibility it can evolve with time into something quite actually the sort of the opposite, this sense of absolute safety and fulfillment. Once again, I talk about this in the article, The Power of Gone. Talk about the various reactions that a person might have to Gone. So, good, clear report. I think we have a hand over there.
It's sort of a follow-up to what he was saying. I spoke about something similar to you yesterday, and so today I attempted to just watch the mind and label the mind. I forgot the out loud part, so
well, you actually in
I
a
couldn't
room
do it
you
here.
Can't really do
yeah.
it out loud too well. You go off by yourself or something.
Yeah, and I found it difficult. Like the same thing that happens if I just do sort of pull out like the regular meditation will happen if I just focus on the mind, which is that I get lost in the thought anyway. And then what I'm finding is the jolt, which I actually really, I think it feels great. I love the jolt. Mm-hmm. But I find that when I'm labeling, I'm doing it in sort of a very violent way. I'm rejecting the thought essentially. Like I find myself thinking I get lost in it, and then when I realize it, I will label it like here, but like in a very...
I understand.
Yeah.
Couple questions. Did you use the label set that I mentioned, meaning you have a see here, none, and gone? Did you use that those words?
I think I forgot the none and gone, but I was using like rest for when nothing was happening.
Yeah, that's an alternative term. And you did see here if you had image and talk at the same time. You did the double label.
Yeah, and it's angry whether it's see here or here.
Uh-huh. So first, I would suggest trying it with spoken labels. Secondly, I would suggest intentionally creating a gentle, matter-of-fact voice. And you can do that, whether it's a mental voice or the spoken voice out loud. It's a little easier to modulate the spoken voice. So I think part of it was not doing it out loud, because that actually makes a big difference, the spoken label. And then, but you got the categories right, which is excellent. I would suggest doing it out loud, and I would suggest artificially creating an equanimity tone, okay? And that you can do. It sounds like this, I'm going to do it from my own mind now, okay? See. It's all going to be CC. I don't have much mental talk, but I get images of the room, okay? But you notice the tone I created in my voice? I made that tone, okay? So can you sort of, as an actress, like say in a really low, impersonal voice, the word see here? Try doing it.
You want me to do it right now?
Yeah, do it. That's self-referential feel, and just let that happen. You don't have to close your eyes. Just imitate the voice quality.
Okay. See. Here. See.
Yeah, that's it. And you may have heard the expression, fake it till you make it. Okay. So you may recall earlier in the day, I sort of threw out a little bit of a zinger, but didn't really make a big deal out of it. I define mindful awareness as concentration, clarity, and equanimity working together. And I said that in the labeling process, the pacing of the label guarantees a certain amount of continuity of concentration. The wording of the label is precise, and that gives you your base level of sensory clarity, and then the voice tone, creating the voice tone, the equanimity tone in the voice, gentle, low, matter of fact, whether it's your physically spoken voice or your mental voice. And a person can modulate that. You could just, you might say, well, it's artificial. I'm really totally freaking out. I'm not in equanimity. I'm in the opposite of equanimity. But you can make the equanimity voice like an actor would make it. And this is one discovery that was really very counterintuitive, but it works out every single time. And what the discovery is, my sort of joking way to describe it is, apparently the tail can wag the dog. And I'll explain what that means. So, you know, it's like, what do you mean the tail can wag the dog? Tail's just a little piece. The dog's what's really there, right? When we say the tail's wagging the dog, it's sort of like this reversal thing. So I work with people via telephone. People call me. People that come to my programs on a regular basis, they get my contact information. And so I get calls from students. And usually, if they're going to call me, it's because there's a crisis, something bad. And they need to be reminded of what they already know, how to practice. So I'm sort of sorry when I get a lot of these calls, because it's like, hey, I just got mugged, or friend just committed suicide. Yeah, I mean, it's often sort of bad. Or they have pain issues, and they're having a flare-up with pain. And so sometimes some of these calls are hysterical. People are crying and even screaming. In those cases, my main job is to get them to fake the equanimity voice with spoken labels for about a half hour. And sometimes they're faking that voice in between screaming and sobbing. I don't care if they scream and sob. That's fine. That doesn't get in the way at all. But the labels have to be impersonal, gentle, matter of fact. And sometimes it takes a while, okay, to just be able to do that form. I let them scream, I let them cry if they want to, but they're doing spoken labels, and the label tone has to be impersonal and matter of fact. And it may take, in extreme cases, as long as a half an hour before they can even get that quality in their voice if it's a really bad news freakout thing. But then, if they can sustain that artificial quality in the voice for another half hour or so, inevitably they drop into authentic equanimity. And I call that the tail wagging the dog, because it's counterintuitive. Let's say, if any of you are therapists, by the way, this is something good to know. You wouldn't think it would have happened. You would think, well, you're faking it, and there's no way that that's going to have any significant impact on your relationship to what's coming up. But actually it does. So I would say, sort of be an actress, make that tone, sustain it with spoken labels, see here, none. That's sort of my official label for none. And maybe the gons or not, as you wish. And I think if you sustain it with spoken labels and that quality in the voice, you definitely want to lose the edge that you're describing. Okay, that's really counterproductive. And then if the thoughts trigger a lot of emotion in the body, feel in, that's actually a little bit of a window of opportunity. That's another interaction. You know, that thought tends to create that feeling tone. Then what you can do is divide and conquer. You work a little while just with the image, just with the talk, then just with the emotional body. See if you can detect the local splash and the global spread of that emotion. Give it permission to happen as frequently as seldom, to last as long or as short as it wants. That's your equanimity piece. It's hard to do that. But this is an example of sort of loving it to death. And if you're willing to do that, and if you're willing to do that over and over again, it sort of takes care of itself relatively quickly. And then you're sort of free for the rest of your life. It's like lancing a boil. You know, it's like, it's ugly, it's painful, but it sort of gets the poison out, and then you're done with it. If you don't do that, the poison is hidden inside. It circulates invisibly, causing psycho-spiritual toxicity for your whole life. So I would just say, you know, go toe-to-toe with it. Implement some of these procedures. I think you're great because you're able to follow all this. You know exactly what I'm describing to do. And you might be surprised that, you know, relatively quickly you start to get a wedge into it.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Now, yeah, we'll not favor the right over the left. The red over the blue.
When I'm practicing CN, it seems like there's two different types of experiences that I have. The first one is, if I see kind of light forms or little pixels going around, it seems like it's right in the front of my visual screen, right there in front. It's very easy to kind of sense where that is. But the other type of seeing that happens for me is like if a sound triggers something that it seems like it's coming from memory, like, you know, I have my eyes closed and then I picture an ambulance or something in my head. It seems a lot more difficult to detect where that is on the visual screen. It seems almost like it's coming from behind. I'm just wondering, are those two different things, you know, seeing kind of little light and dark things with my eyes closed, or if the sun comes up or down, versus getting triggered from memory?
Okay. So we're going to sharpen up some definitions, and I'm going to answer your question. So within my system, CIN is an abbreviation for mental image. And mental image is, by definition, visual thought. So what that means is that those sort of swirls of color or geometric forms or pixelations or sort of floaters, that kind of stuff, those actually are not under the category of CN. Those are sort of a sea flow or maybe a sea rest kind of experience. Although they are visual, they're not really thought, okay? So the CN has to have those two characteristics. It's visual thought. Now, in other words, it's just it's a jargon way of saying mental image. Often people assume that to count as a mental image, it has to be vivid and or stable. But the great majority of people, if they're consciously aware of visual thought at all, and many people are not aware of it at all, okay? But if people are aware of it, typically it's sort of vague and fleeting. It's just a vague impression that's sort of there and not there. It's ghostly. It's like a old-fashioned X-ray or something like that. So that's what most of the CN is, if it's there at all. So mental images occur in image space. For most people, image space is one or a combination, or involves one or a combination of three subspaces. Sorry, this is the geek speak, okay? The first one tends to be in front of and or behind the eyes. It can be sort of like a screen, or it can have some depth as a stage. Some people, it's two layered. They've got one sort of here and one more back here. But it's sort of like a mental screen. Not that it looks like a TV screen, but it's a location. It's a stage or a screen. That's where memory plan fantasy imagery tends to occur. Then there's sort of around, okay? That's where ambient images tend to occur. For example, what you mentioned, images triggered by sounds will often seem to be in the direction whence the sound came. Not inevitably, and there's no right or wrong about it. You seem to get them sort of behind, okay? But if the sound's in front of you, you may actually sort of get it projected in front. So there's sort of like the ambient image space. And subtle is significant. Those images of your surroundings with your eyes closed are what actually create the prison of time and space that convince you, I'm only here, only now. And the extent to which you fully experience them so they just flow, to that extent you actually, is mindfulness here and now? Well, yeah, mindfulness is be here, be now, but it's be here and be now so fully that you're nowhere and everywhere. So by fully experiencing those ambient images, and when they break up, and when you, quote, penetrate that, that's part of attaining the formless jhanas, then you actually, if you close your eyes, it seems like you're nowhere and always. You're free from the trammels of time and space. So ambient images, they're very subtle. For most people, they're even below the threshold of awareness. But subtle is significant. That's the second part of image space, possibly. The third part of image space is images associated with self, body, my appearance. You get a sensation in your knee, and you sort of get an impression of your knee. So that's the self-body part of image space. And those three spaces taken together are the totality of your image space. So the answer to your question is yes. Different locations will tend to have different content with regards to visual thought. Okay. Yes. We need to get the mic.
So I just want to follow up on their question about the herein. It might be similar, but I feel like there's a slight distinction in this. So I was experiencing the same thing. I would space out, jolt back in, and be like, "Oh, I was gone." I was having mental thought, and then as soon as I come back, basically any time I would label here from mental thought. It would automatically it would end that thought.
Yes.
So is that I don't know, is that okay? Is that what should be happening?
That is okay, and that is what happens in the great majority of cases. Most people, as soon as they acknowledge mental talk, the mental talk just stops. And that is often considered problematic, but it is not in the slightest problematic. It is, in fact, insight into impermanence. So you simply are aware of the ending. It's a gone. You can even label it that way if you want. The other common report is if I place my attention in talk space, because if you're going to observe mental talk, positioning your attention where the mental talk is likely to occur, which for most people is sort of in the head, at the ears, I call that talk space. Positioning the attention in talk space and keeping it spatially sustained there is really important. That's a lot of the reason that you might miss the talk is that your attention goes somewhere else. It goes to your body or to something visual or something, and you're not in talk space anymore because you have to be right there, Johnny on the spot. Okay, it's like talk space, if you imagine that the talk is a mouse, and so talk space is the mouse hole, and you're not trying to kill the mouse when it comes out of the hole, okay? You're not jumping on it like the cat to kill it, but what you're doing is you're going to observe that hole, and if the mouse wants to come out and play, then you note, talk, okay? But the fact is, as soon as you note it, the mouse may run in back into the hole, okay? That's okay, that's a gone. Or the fact that you're watching the hole, the mouse doesn't come out of the hole, okay? Once again, that is not problematic in the slightest. What you then are having is you're positioned in talk space, there's no talk activity, there's a none. There's a non-arising. So then you hear the noble silence. You listen to the absence of talk moment by moment and you get used to, oh, this is what it's like to have a quiet mind. So it's all good, okay? A large part of my job is to partition experience into logical possibilities, okay? In other words, procedure X, either A, B, C, or D will happen. They're mutually exclusive. They're collectively exhaustive. It's got to be one. It can only be one. And we're not going to put any valence on any of them. So it's a valence-free partition of logical possibilities with an optimal response strategy for each contingency. Now, there's geek speak. That's the way a guy who thinks like an engineer and has meditated for about 50 years talks, okay? So, in other words, you position your attention in talk space. Either the talk activates in a sustained way and you observe it, or the fact that you're observing it causes it to end, and you notice the end as a gone, or the fact that you're observing it causes it to go quiet, and you enjoy the quiet as a rest state, you hear rest, as opposed to the hear the talk. And you know, if you do that for long enough, now you got used to that and you can reproduce it and have mental quiet on demand. The other contingency is the mouse goes back into the hole, but it doesn't go to sleep. It frolics around a little bit, but below the threshold of awareness. And you get this sort of subtle undercurrent of activity and talk space. That's your subconscious mind. You can't detect the content, but you can detect the contour. You can take its general level of kinetic energy, which is its temperature, how active or deactive that subtle stirring is. Now you're unblocking the subconscious mind, and that turns into the wisdom mind. So there's only like those possibilities if you're in talk space, and each one is natural, and there's something optimal to do in each case. In the way that I like to formulate mindfulness, one of the fundamental axioms is the act of observing may change the sensory experience. That is not a problem. We're not like getting into some weird Heisenberg conundrum where we can never experience what's really there because as soon as we look, it's already changed, blah, 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 blah. If you don't go there, okay? Just don't go there. Here's why not. Because we're interested in sensory reality. And since fully experiencing the senses. And it doesn't matter what causes the sensory experience. It's not like a sensory experience that happens spontaneously is more authentic than a sensory experience that happens because you turned your attention towards something. It doesn't matter what causes it. A sensory event is a sensory event. And so if the observing causes a change, just observe the change. End of story. So that's what I have to say about that.
Just one quick follow-up. So you're staying in the talk space, that's like a specific technique to
option in see, hear, feel. Okay. So what I introduced to you folks was probably like, maybe it wasn't too much information, but it was probably right on the cusp of more than you wanted to hear, okay, in a weekend program. But this is just the tip of the iceberg of my algorithm. There's 24 ways you can customize see, hear, feel to investigate the systems and subsystems and elements of the senses. And one of them is, okay, we're going to restrict to just herein. Or its absence, or its vanishing. And that's like, and then you can work with the parts, and then you can, so, you know, I'm from LA originally. And so, New York's probably a little bit similar, you know, a lot of entertainment industry stuff. So I've got a lot of my students are in the entertainment industry. They produce, or, you know, not actors so much, but like, you know, they make movies. So how does a director or a camera person, what do? Well, a lot of times it's a rhythm. There's an establishing shot, and then you cut from different points of view, right? And then you go back to the establishing shot, and then you sort of, there's a close-up on this one, a close-up on this one, a close-up on this one. And that in it keeps your interest, and it also reveals the action. So one of the options in my algorithm is, okay, you sort of go the big picture, and then you sort of look at the individual parts. And then you go back to seeing the big picture again, and it's clearer, okay, then you go to the individual parts. So one of the parts you could go to would be inner auditory activation, in other words, mental talk.
Did you know
he's
a sound engineer?
Yeah, I also...
No, I didn't. Well, yes, I did. Coverage. Of course, it was totally psychic. There's no other explanation. Sorry. No coincidence. I totally knew this. You all, yeah, sorry.
Thanks. Well, I guess I just had more of a report that was interesting with the ambient images. So it's happened to me a few times now recently that, kind of when I come out of the meditation, or when I open my eyes, it just takes me a few seconds to kind of re-remember where I am, or just kind of re-familiarize myself with the dimensions of my body. Or it's been an interesting experience, just kind of like, oh, this room, this is where I am now. And yeah, it's just been interesting.
So there's a little disorientation for a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not alarmed. It's just kind of, I have to re-remember, like, oh yeah, my bedroom.
Right.
That's where I am.
That's good. That's actually really good, because you're letting go of the fixation in time and space. And actually, what I would encourage is that you not intentionally reorient yourself. If you reorient spontaneously, fine. But you don't actually have to reorient yourself. You can sort of get up, throw caution to the wind, and just start functioning from an unfixated state. And that's one of the ways that Zen spontaneity is developed. Mm-hmm. See, there's the impermanence of observing your senses, and then there's the, which is sensory, the sensory impermanence. But then there's also motor impermanence. There's the impermanence of right, there's how your speech and your body movements, how they ride on the flow of impermanence. And Zen training emphasizes that a lot. It's called Zen spontaneity. Like, you go in for these Zen interviews and they ask you questions you don't know how to answer, and yet you have to answer, and you just sort of blurt something out, and it's sort of like energetic and magic and intuitive. And the way that one of the ways that that's trained is like, you practice and you're a little disoriented, and instead of sort of, okay, I got to reorient, you just start functioning from that place of unfixatedness, okay, that authentic human with no fixed position. That's how you train her. Okay. And then your impermanence is not just in the sense gates, it's also what you ride on, and it gives a kind of bouncy, spontaneous vitality to how you speak and move. Mm-hmm. And Zen emphasizes that. Actually, they train that before they train enlightenment. That's the first thing they train. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's a kind of dynamic liveliness to Zen that is often absent in Theravada practice, for example. But I sort of appreciate that aspect of Zen. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to orient yourself. Okay. I mean, if you orient spontaneously, fine. But all you need to do is speak and move appropriately. And if you sort of throw caution to the wind, you learn how to channel yourself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Great.
Okay, well, maybe one more, and then we'll have a brief practice period. We'll cap it off.
Hi. I have a question about intention. This sticks with me, I've already asked Janusz and Raquel this question, but I wanted to hear from you. Someone I met years ago who, used Zen meditation in context with very existentialist and nihilist worldviews to sort of create
existentialist and
and nihilist sort of worldviews to create further connection with nothingness. And what is the danger of that happening, of getting into a nihilism of recognizing that as we don't have a self, there is nothing.
I'm assuming that, or are you implying that the result of that was that cocktail was toxic?
Yes, I felt very disturbed by that.
Can you tell me in specific what was disturbing about it?
Um, it seemed to be using a practice to move in the direction of having no hope, not living, not being, but in a way that was, and I guess that's the question of intention, not moving towards Dharma, but moving towards darkness.
In the sense of being depressed and ineffectual in the world?
Yes, senseless.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah, right. So then there's the question of course, intention.
Yeah, how to avoid that?
How to avoid that, of course. But then is it even, transcending the self in some way, or how do we know we won't move towards feeling disconnected opposed to more connected?
Yeah. You've already sort of basically solved the problem because you realize that it is a problem, okay? It's people that don't realize that this is a problem that are likely to roll down that slippery slope. So probably, you don't have to worry about that. Like I say, it's the people that don't see that as a problem that for whom it's likely to be a problem. One way is to have at least one competent coach that you study with, because a competent coach will not let you go there, okay? They'll be watching for that kind of stuff. And if there's any tendency in that direction, they'll sort of correct it. So from a practical point of view, that's one of the reasons that you want to, I don't believe in surrendering to teachers, but I do believe there's something called expert opinion, and it's something that, should be valued. So a competent teacher won't let that happen. That's one thing. And just philosophically, even within the Zen tradition itself, what you're describing is called Tenma Zen. They have a word for it. So, as the idiom goes, this shit has happened before, okay? And it's happened in Asia, because there's an Asian term for it, okay? And of course, the fact that there's a term is because they point out that's like, this is like really not Zen, okay, or whatever. It's Tenma Zen. That means it's demonic Zen, literally. It's a real put-down term, Tenma. Tenma means Mara, Ma is Mara, okay? So it's like, that's just not the way to go. It's nihilistic Zen. It's like, well, everything's empty, so nothing matters, and nothing's any fun, and I can be a total asshole, and it's all void, so who gives a shit, okay? That's Tenma Zen. And the Zen tradition is adamant that ain't where it's at. Where it's at is that there's this paradox that there is no thing, but cause and effect is not to be ignored, okay? There may not be any things, no things that get caused or affected, but cause and effect is not to be ignored. And if you ignore cause and effect, then that's Zen sickness.
Is it important to keep enlightenment in mind as a goal towards this, as that will keep a person from?
I mean, there's, enlightenment is a real tricky word.
Okay.
I think it's important to keep a balance between every between emptiness and responsibility. And in fact, in really deep practice, emptiness is responsibility. I know that sounds strange, because we tend to think, oh, well, they might be like opposites or something. But in really deep practice, responsibility arises from the emptiness spontaneously, the ceaselessly responding, compassionate void. And that's what I have to say about that. Okay. Thanks to Dharma Punks and New York Insight for making this happen for us.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.